when people are sensitive about that.
I know, that's right. But that's what we do.
All righty. Service activities. Let's start there. Please talk about any service activities that may have been particularly meaningful to you, apart from Wisely, which is covered in the next section. Perhaps your involvement with creating a collaborative learning environment and with the CALS Instructional Improvement Committee, or have we already covered?
No, I don't think we did.
Okay.
One of the good parts about this job is that we are allowed to follow our areas of interest. Some of us, other people who have PhDs in science, continue to teach in their discipline. I never was teaching in my discipline, and it's very hard to continue research in your discipline very part-time. That's just the nature of science. You can't just kind of do it part-way because you have to know what other people are doing. You have to stay on top of it. So I didn't continue that, but I did pursue some of my other interests. So let's talk about one area, and then I'll get back to CCLE and the Teaching Academy and CALS Instructional Improvement Committee, which are really more related to my job. They are actually my job. I've always had this interest in diversity. And so when I came back from Australia, I got involved in the newly formed Asian American Studies program. All along, I had been a member of this PAWA, Pacific Asian Women's Alliance. And it's a group of women, Asian women, who just did all sorts of things. I mean, we promoted sort of better understanding of what it was like to be Asian. So, for example, we sponsored a film festival on campus. Anyway, PAWA took a lead role in bringing about the the ethnic studies, it's not a department, but it was a, what's the word I'm thinking for?
Not a whole department, I know.
It's not a whole
Institute,
department.
Maybe?
Yeah, it's Asian American, it's a program, that's really what it is. And it fulfilled the, it was because of the ethnic studies requirement in some ways. But in any case, by the time I left, it was just formed, and Amy Ling was the director when I came back, and so I was on the faculty advisory committee for that program. Now, that program is really far from sciences; it's really a social science and humanities. She was in the English department, but it really meant a lot to me because it had been really important to me to find my identity. And what I was hoping to do was to provide for that program the input from the community, from the Asian community, and also from people who are Asian who are scientists, to try to help bring that perspective of having a broad curriculum, having a broad area of study. And actually, I've been on that faculty advisory committee since I came back, 1992, and I'm still on it. And so I think that's one piece of diversity that I've been involved in. We got involved in a lot of hires, for example, as well as trying to help the very small number of faculty do a very large job. So we helped with the student aspects. So there are many student groups that are Asian, Asian American student groups. And so attending those functions and providing mentoring. Another area that I've been involved in is the Chancellor Scholars. I've been a mentor for, two Chancellor Scholars. You become a mentor when they first come onto campus, and then you stay with those students until they graduate, if it's 4 or 5 years. And that's been very rewarding to me. Outside of the university, I also volunteered at the Bayview Center, tutoring Hmong students. So all of this because of my interest in diversity.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
How have these things changed on campus over the last 10 or 15 years? Either the groups or the, you know, the type of people or the their functioning or whatever. Tell me how
it's... Oh, yeah. The number of Southeast Asian students who are on this campus has greatly increased. You can tell that. I mean, early on, you know, what we were doing was we were helping in Bayview to help them fill out applications to come to this university. Now it's a huge student group. I attended one of their first annual cultural event, and the Great Hall was filled. So that's changed a lot.
What were the numbers like when they went?
The numbers? Well, Southeast Asians, probably. I mean, very, very few. I don't have the numbers.
No, I'm just roughly. Are we talking? It's a group of tens of people. You think back then?
Yeah, probably.
And now
because
hundreds.
They were, yeah.
It's a big change.
It's a big change. And many of those students are interested in the sciences, and so participating is very rewarding because I feel like I can do something for it.
Sorry. I've been up three nights in a row. Nothing to do with anything you're saying. My wife and daughter are out of town, so I'm doing all things I never get to do. When
I see.
Last night, and I built the swing set the night before, so I've had all these late night activities, and I'm starting to catch up on
the list. Yeah. let's see, what other things have I been doing? So actually I'm also, have we talked about CERTL, the Center for Integration of Research, Teaching and Learning? That's actually part of my job. It's an NSF funded grant. I've been involved since the writing of that grant, and now I'm on the, part of my job is to work with the instructional materials development team. I'm one of the leaders of that team. And also I'm one of the instructors for the course, at least now. The team is formulating these courses. So I'm doing that. But there are three pillars for that CERTL project. One of them is teaching as research. Another one is diversity. And the third is a learning community. These are for the STEM disciplines, for science, technology.
Yeah, you did mention this, I do remember.
Okay, so I'm also working on the diversity committee for that. And so I'm able to work on helping them develop resources that integrate the diversity aspects of in the classroom, inclusiveness in the classroom, right into this handbook that's for on how to prepare your course, how to teach your course.
Yes.
So I'm able to sort of bring in some of my views on diversity that way. So I don't suppose that's exactly volunteer work, but I don't think there is many people.
And service work, then.
It is service.
That it's not part of your
normal. It's not part of my normal work.
And what are your views on diversity?
My views on diversity.
I think that I'm able to bring in some of my views.
Yeah, I think with I see from various student groups. So, for example, I'm one of the advisors for AHANA, which is the minority student group in biological sciences. They're actually pre-health sciences students. They did some skits, and what we learned from those students, for really listening, is that they have a very painful time here on this campus. And one of the things is it's not from intentional things, it's unintentional things. Things that are done just from when you think you're helping. And some of the problems occur because of the instructors directly maybe overly paying attention to students who are minorities. Selecting them out when they have problems, making them therefore feel like they weren't exactly included. But other things are, we now have a lot in science, we have a lot of small group work. Not the instructors maybe are not as aware that the students have more difficulty when they're in small groups where the instructor is not overseeing it. So all of the assumptions that students have about each other come out in full force.
Right.
And so in the skits, for example, from AHANA, they describe about how Sometimes their views are not, they don't get credit for contributions that they make, or assumptions are made by students that they just don't want to be part of when the group gets together, things like that. So helping the campus become more aware of the way that the students are feeling and what possible role they might be having, either intentional or not intentional, is something that I think is really important on our campus for the climate. And that works both ways. For Asian students, sometimes they're overlooked when they have problems because people assume that they're good. They're quiet because they know everything. So it's both ways.
Yeah, and you've got race issues, you've got, I imagine, language issues fuse into all of this as well.
Right.
They're international students.
That's right. And international students are sometimes not included in groups in graduate school, you know, study groups and things like that. So informal groups, access to networks, that is, anyone who's a little bit different will find that. It's not just race. I have a lot more views on that, but basically, and of course, you know, gender,
feel free to follow them.
Gender follows there too. I mean, my interest in gender issues with Wisely, I mean, there's many of the same issues we're talking about here. Feeling not included, women. Let's see, I don't want to lose track of where we're going here in terms of the service.
It's okay to wander.
I think we've pretty much handled the service. The other thing is they joke about it, I'm almost a life member on the Equity and Diversity Committee. I've been reappointed several times to that committee, which is a university-wide committee. It's the Equity and Diversity Committee. It's actually Equity and Diversity Resource Center Advisory Committee. And I've enjoyed that committee because it gives you an opportunity to actually make a difference.
Tell me why. We're getting the interesting part of the whole thing. Quiet on me. This is the interesting part.
Well, for example,
taking on the tough issues.
For example, right now, at this moment in time, there are many, many different groups doing many different things on behalf of diversity. But one group doesn't know what the other group is doing. We have just appointed a vice chancellor for diversity issues, Verna Strand, and she's certainly going to make a big difference. But she can't do it all on her own. And so this committee, one of the things we're trying to do in this committee is to try to listen to what she has in mind and help to bring our efforts in alignment with what she's trying to do. So for example, educational materials. What are the sorts of things that the different groups are doing that could be pulled together for new faculty? How would be the best way to share those materials? What about students of color who come to this campus and they have a painful experience? Would they know from the many, many groups where they can go to have an ear to listen to them? One of the thoughts is that the Equity and Diversity Resource Center, because of its name, people may be finding their way there, and then they won't find what they need because this particular center is under the legal arm of the university. And while we don't expect that the center will do all things, it might be a place where they could put together
point.
Right of what where. So in other words, can we as this committee help to have an educational role that will make that website a jumping off point for finding what people need? That's one of the things that we're thinking about. The other thing is that this equity and diversity. So the Equity and Diversity Resource Center, advisory committee also oversees the reports that are from these, each unit has an equity and diversity committee. And so the...
No, no, it's okay. Each unit has to file a report.
Right. Each unit at the university, that means colleges and has to file a report from their equity and diversity committee. And it was left intentionally vague. The faculty senate formed these committees. Vague exactly what these committees would do, just so that they could do what was necessary in their particular unit. Each unit has a culture. And so this committee can help the unit committees know what each other are doing. And so there's actually a subgroup of our committee that is overseeing that. But we look at these reports and we can help with that educational piece. What would help these groups be more effective?
Gotcha.
So it's very exciting.
Yeah.
You know, we're not exactly in the center. We're not in the center. But we can do something.
Yeah. I'm not supposed to say things for you.
No, is that right?
I can hardly say anything.
Not very.
So is it that you're providing feedback to them to help them improve how they go about doing various things, and helping them figure out what to do next, kind of thing?
Well, I don't think it's so much feedback. It's listening and trying to hear where there are needs and how, and then just figuring out how we can help this subcommittee that's actually the equity and diversity's how they run their own orientation programs, things like that. But how can we provide them with information that we might know about?
Gotcha. Now you told me you've been on this committee. You're a life member.
No, it's only a couple of terms. Okay. It's like 6 years or something like that.
And has it changed over that 6 year period? Even? I mean, are the issues people are facing different, or are the
It's changed a lot.
Okay.
It's changed a lot. But I think it's not so much because of the time as the particular leadership. Leadership can go in the direction in which they're interested. And also the needs of the Equity and Diversity Resource Center. It is the legal arm. And so one of our charges is to look over the process of complaints. So can we write it more clearly how a person would write a complaint to the university? So there is that legal aspect too. Right now, the way we're moving is, and I think the whole campus is moving, is to think about climate. These are non-legal issues. And so...
Why do you suppose it is? Why do you suppose it shifts taking place?
The shift's taken place because of a number of different groups. There's the Women's Committee, the Committee on Women, I guess it's called, took a big, wrote a report on climate. They really stuck their necks out, I think, to talk about lived experiences. They told the stories of what's happening on this campus. And that started a whole set of activities. The other thing is there was a sexual harassment workshop, and that dealt with the legality issues. But the discussions went beyond that, like what is legal and what are just the things that we really should be paying attention to. They're not illegal, but they certainly aren't helping women feel included. So those things happened. Wisely came around. I think that those are some of the big factors that led to this.
I was trying to find a way to ask this. Is it that the interest and the energy is growing? Is this a positive thing? The interest and energy is growing beyond just sort of legal, covering various people's rears and making sure we're not doing anything illegal, mm-hmm. to, okay, well, let's work on, that's the impression I have, is that it's going to, now let's work on improving the climate, which will make this, which will both reduce those problems as well as mm-hmm. make it a better place. I mean, is that what's happening, or am I being more optimistic than it merits?
I think part of it is, when you're working on the rules, when you're working on the law, like let's not get sued, right? We only need those laws, in my opinion, because we can't count on people to do what is the right thing. And so the worst things that could happen are the things that we write laws about. But it's not like there's a line there. And we have to also recognize, why do we actually want to have this inclusive environment? Why do we not want to have people feel bad about this? And that's just as important. And so I guess it seems to me that, like, for example, when they wrote the little brochure on sexual harassment, these are the things that you must not do because they're for legal reasons. But there is a whole paragraph on that brochure that tells about why do we not want to have this. People can't work their best when they're feeling this way. And the university can work much better. Everybody will be happier. Everything, not just those people.
Right.
So I think that's one of the, I don't really draw a line.
Mm-hmm. Right. There. If you talk about one, it naturally bleeds into the other. So.
Right. And I think to some extent, as I've gone through my career, when I was doing research, you just didn't want to say that, you couldn't put your finger on what were the reasons why, you never complain. You just do whatever you had to do. So you wouldn't say, this is because I'm a woman that this happened. You wouldn't be sure it was because you were a woman. Or, this is because I'm a minority, that's why that happened. Oh, you wouldn't know that. And so you don't want to just start bleating that, oh, poor me, all these things are happening. So you just do what you need to do to be successful. And I've never really thought of myself as being a woman scientist or a Asian woman scientist or anything like that. But I've always been interested in it. And I find that now that I'm older, things are sort of coming together. And what I'm interested in, which is helping to improve education in the biological sciences, of course I can bring in some of these aspects of diversity and you know, that has to do with being a minority, and also that has to do with being a woman. I just did this last semester for the Center for Biology Education. I applied for a grant to the Institute on Race and Ethnicity. They have book clubs. They sponsor the buying of books so that a book group can get together and read a book on race and ethnicity. And so our unit, Center for Biology Education, read and discussed these two books. And it was really interesting to talk about how these impact our various jobs and what we might do differently. And I mean, I see that as an example of pulling together my interests and what we do. It's kind of coming together.
And what were the books?
One of the books was Race in the College Classroom.
Okay.
Book. And the other one was A Place to be Navajo. We probably could have picked a few other books, but those were the two we chose. And we also did a reading, some readings. One of the readings was from Virginia Vallien's book, Why So Slow? And that book was brought to my attention by Wiseman. And what I really liked about that was the idea of having of gender schemas, that we it's not, you know, we're not bad people. All of us, men and women, carry these schemas about groups. You could say women or different
right.
people of different races. We carry these images, these schemas about these people, and so it's unintentional. And we just have to be aware of those if we're trying to make changes. And so we read the one chapter there, because it does relate to race as well as to gender. So, like I said, it's also volunteer. So do you? We should get into the other things that I do on campus that are really related to the job. One of the things that the Center for Biology Education does is it tries to work and partner with other groups. So in order, if you think of the mission to improve undergraduate, well, we say across the, for me, it's to improve undergraduate biology education. There's lots of different groups that are involved. One of the groups is the CALS Instructional Improvement Committee. This is the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, which includes a lot of biological sciences, but in addition, it has some social sciences. And I've been working together with that group, and it's been a good collaboration because the instructors and the faculty who are on that committee have a touch on the real world, so the real world of the instructor. And I don't have that because I'm not an instructor. On the other hand, they don't have the knowledge of what other professional development events are occurring, and also what things have been successful in the past. And so with those two together, we are able to, I'm pretty proud of that group and our collaboration in bringing forward some really good programs, such as the program Innovation in Teaching, Novel Approaches to Knotty Problems, where we spotlighted a department for each brown bag and had four faculty from that department talk about what novel approaches they took to what knotty problems. And it was a very good program because by choosing four people, you get beyond the one person who is the person who's interested in teaching. Right? You get four people, some of whom are thinking, I'm not really known for my teaching, but I did notice this big problem, and this is what I did about it. Mm-hmm. And so we did summaries. We collected summaries of those presentations, put them on the web, and they were actually partly because of my involvement in the Teaching Academy. Many of those summaries were included in the newsletter of the Teaching Academy when they wanted to have articles at the beginning. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a set of articles to publish in the newsletter, and so they used some of those summaries in the Teaching Academy's newsletter. So this is what I mean. This is just an example of how by being active in a lot of different venues, you can actually make the whole work better. Yeah. So that brings us to, I should also say that in the CALS Instructional Improvement Committee, what I get out of it is I get the perspective of the instructors, and I really get a better idea of what the needs are. So that when I run programs from the Center for Biology Education, I know that there's a group that that needs that. So the other group that I've really enjoyed is CCLE. You mentioned that. It's not actually around anymore, but I was very active in it for maybe 6 or 7 years. And that was creating a collaborative learning environment. When I first started out, I was thinking, you know, I think it's best to do these programs to help faculty make connections from a discipline. I still feel that way. But working with CCLE, which was cross-disciplinary, gave me a very good perspective on the best points for being cross-disciplinary. CCLE would bring people from humanities, social sciences, biological and physical sciences together. And we spent an hour and a half a week with these people for a full year, not focusing on teaching, but on learning and using our own little group of about 10 people to see how we learn. And to do readings and to reflect on them with respect to ourselves and sharing with each other. So at the end, there were some joint activities, and the joint activities included making a consensus diagram of how people learn. And what I thought was good about this is because all of the disciplines are represented, you get lots of different ways that people learn. It gets carried home in a real way that we don't all think alike. And maybe our students don't either. And it also gives you a reason when you're making changes in a classroom to reach all sorts of people. It can be discouraging. Your ratings can go, your student evaluations can go down. What's to keep you from jumping back to the old way? Well, this whole year of thinking about what are all the factors that influence how people learn, you realize that you can't just make one little change into your class. It's going to affect lots of things. And you need to pay attention to lots of different things. So you don't give up. If you make some changes and it doesn't work right away, you know why you're doing it, and you know how those different pieces of the puzzle fit together. Not only that, you have a community. So in a lot of ways, CCLE had a big influence on this CERTL grant, where learning community is important. A lot of the people that I interacted with in CCLE are now very active in CERTL. And so, you know, it's some things coming back together again. I mean, I'm not the only one who's working in several different venues. CCLE also helped me because the people who were leaders in CCLE they paid attention to the whole person. They weren't just intellectual, they weren't just cognitive, which is that's my most comfortable realm, I'd have to say. You know, to think it all through. And they were much more interested in the feeling side. And so it's helped me a lot to get that perspective and to put that into the way I'm thinking. You know, this idea of Parker Palmer's that we were talking about earlier, his book on The Courage to Teach. Right now, a lot of teachers have read that book. I never would have thought to introduce that as a reading. I would have introduced a study on evidence for improved learning, data the show. Right, I never would have thought to introduce an article that actually talks about why are we teachers? How is it that our value system and that sort of thing plays out in our classroom? It's not the kind of approach I had. And so this group has really helped me a lot to look that way. And I don't know, it hasn't been in the past. I haven't taken that approach. So let's see, what other volunteer work? Teaching Academy. Originally, I didn't think that I belonged to the Teaching Academy. I was very happy when the Teaching Academy formed a number of years ago, because it seemed to me that the Teaching Academy was in a unique position to, since it was formed by the Faculty Senate, to raise the status of spending time on your teaching. We're at a Research One university. We all know that the research is important. Well, what about this teaching piece? And so I figured that it should be actually the faculty involved. And I still feel that way. I feel it's got a unique position. But Jeff Harden, one of the faculty members in zoology, was a member of the Teaching Academy, and he asked to nominate me. And I explained to him about that. I don't actually teach. How could I be in the Teaching Academy? And he said, well, you know, that's a very narrow definition of teaching. What you do is exactly what could be considered teaching. You bring things to people's attention. You help them think about new ways or possible things that they could do, and then they go ahead and do it. That's also teaching.
Right.
And so I was inducted into the Teaching Academy, and recently, and then I've spent the three years on the Executive Committee of the Teaching Academy. I still feel that the Teaching Academy needs to be led by faculty, because we haven't gotten into the place where the status of teaching for faculty is high enough. And if it's being led by people who are not faculty, it sends a message just that this is for people who are in instruction. And I really do feel that the instruction, the teaching informs the research, and the research informs the teaching. So, but I was active in the Teaching Academy. I'm still active in the Teaching Academy's Summer Institute, which is a 4-day intensive institute for people who have a project, a course they want to work on. They can go to a place off campus and spend 4 days working on it. And then there's some large group parts of the Summer Institute, and then there's small groups, and so the small groups are facilitated by facilitators, and I've been a facilitator. Plus, we've had some role in trying to design what would be the good blend, a good mix of introducing new ideas, which might be sort of proactive, and what are things that everybody recognizes they needed in a reactive way, and just listening to what they need. And responding to it right at the Teaching Academy, the Summer Institute. So I've enjoyed that a lot. Now that's also cross-disciplinary.
And this is an institute their role is to, it's the point of this Summer Institute.
The Summer Institute.
To help people develop their courses back.
Yeah, to give them a time, and a community,
and some help.
And community, and some help to work on it.
That's brilliant.
I want to know about these things that were done. So it's two different. You're talking about two.
I was talking about these two different summer institutes.
Okay.
The Summer Institute of the Teaching Academy it's part of the Teaching Academy, which is part of the institution. It's the institution's Summer Institute. The other Summer Institute, which is the National Academy of Sciences Summer Institute, is national. And that is just biology, so that's discipline specific.
Gotcha.
Okay, and they have different purposes. I mean, my view is that there should be a menu of options. Everybody looks to different places for motivation and for what they need. And there are some people who. Perhaps they're the big name researchers who are getting millions of dollars in research money, who will look to their to the National Academy of Sciences and to their peers in the biological sciences for how they spend their time and what they respect about the materials that are there. And for them, we want to look at what's happening at Stanford and what's happening in Berkeley and what materials are they using and how are they. Now, those same people are also coming to the Teaching Academy, but it might be that they already have gotten their motivation from there, but they now need to go to spend some time, 4 days at the Teaching Academy. The Teaching Academy Summer Institute also might be people who really look to each other on this campus for more help. They might be just totally different types of people, and they may. So their motivation may actually come from this institution. I guess what I'm saying is that there's motivational needs, there's resource needs, and the resource needs may be, we need to have local resources, and so that's where the Teaching Academy comes. There are lots of different things that need to be in place to overcome the barriers for improving teaching.
And you work in both of these.
And I work in both of these. I mean, I think of it as lots of things, the stars all have to be aligned,
right?
To have this moment, a teaching moment,
right.
Happen.
Right.
So I don't work in all of those areas, but I try to help set up where there are gaps, something to be in place. And so that's. But I just wanted to distinguish the differences between the National Academy Summer Institute and the Teaching Academy Summer Institute. Both very worthwhile, working in different arenas, able to do four faculty different things.
And what I understand is that the local one, which is just for our university, You participate every year as a facilitator of small groups. Do you work on the national one as well?
I'm working in a smaller capacity. In the national one, their faculty, some of whom are in the National Academy of Sciences and the Biological Sciences, Joe Handelsman and Bill Woods from Colorado are heading the institute this year. The National Research Council set up a committee of a national committee from many different institutions to sort of lead this whole concept of Summer Institute. And I helped initially to make phone calls, for example, to different institutions, the biology departments, to identify who are the people who are key and are doing a lot of good things in biology.
Gotcha.
This year, the role I'm taking is to make the connections to our campus from that national institute, where they're having teams from different institutions come together, and our campus.
So you're like the liaison.
Liaison, right. Okay. And so organizing a lunch with the Wisconsin people, UW people, we'll be able to come together with the participants, and they can talk about what's happening in the Summer Institute, and also hear a speaker who's talking about how you teach in your own research lab, bringing undergraduates into the research lab. That's what the talk is going to be on. I'm also helping those people who come from other institutions, who are at research institutions, make connections with their colleagues in their disciplines on this campus. So I'm helping to organize the junior faculty giving talks on this campus in different disciplines, research talks. So it's connecting in both ways, I guess. But I don't have, at the Summer Institute and the Teaching Academy, I'm facilitating and I'm helping to plan that one. I guess I'm not helping in as big a way to plan the national
one. You know, I look over your career and it seems like a long way from, you know, the neurological, or I guess probably not the right word, but this initial work that you started doing, which is very much a scientist in a lab with a group of scientists working in a very small, on very specific issues and problems, to being, I mean, that's a huge change in terms of,
yeah.
What do you think of that?
Well, I have to.
It requires a lot of phone calls.
To this. All right, I'm ready to talk about that.
Question is, yes, what do you think about this change in your career over all this time? It's a pretty dramatic change.
It's a pretty dramatic change.
There's been a thread we can follow through, and a good solid thread, but...
Yeah, but you know, remember, I was in high school, I was interested in teaching. I was interested in being, you know, I was at the Future Teachers of America Club, right? I was doing that kind of stuff. And so I've always been interested in education. The other thing is, I was always broad. My major was in psychology, and it was from that viewpoint, you know, visual illusions, that I came into neuroscience. And so it was actually one of the reasons why I wanted to, why I found being in a research lab more and more dissatisfying, is because I was getting to be an expert into a narrower and narrower piece. I mean, this idea of being an expert on the posterior medial lateral supraciliar cortex of a cat.
It's
just
that?
Not what I had in mind, actually. I mean, I loved the question. The question that we were looking at in research was plasticity and development of the nervous system, the visual system, and how much is it hardwired from the beginning, and how much of it could change. So let's say you had some brain damage or something. How much could recover? And what would be the mechanisms of that recovery? And so we were studying a system that seemed to recover after early damage, and when the damage was done later on in adulthood, it didn't recover in the same way. This area could take over the functions of the part that was damaged, but only in the young animal. So if we could understand that, then maybe we could do something. It's a really important question, and also I was very interested in the processing of information in the visual system. Where does it get processed? And so as you're looking at the development and you're looking at recovery of function, you're also understanding about the development of the processing of visual information. It's fascinating. But because it's so broad, and you have to know so much about all these different areas, you do become somewhat specialized. And in order to be continue to be broad, it's a full-time job. The other thing is, because I wasn't teaching, I didn't have to put all of what I was doing in the research lab into the broader context of what do we know about the nervous system, the whole nervous system, the whole body. I was getting to be too narrow. So I would say that the other thing is I've always liked people, and that's this idea of being a teacher. I like people. And being in the research lab was just a small number of people. So this is probably more what I had intended to the kind of thing that I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be, to make a contribution somehow. And I know that you can make contributions in science, and I was making contributions in science, but it wasn't the kind of contribution that I had in mind for myself. Different, thank goodness, different people like to do different things.
Yep.
So, and not only that, thank goodness you can do different things at different times in your life.
Right.
So I'd say I loved science. That I just can't believe, I still can't believe that I was able to do that for so long and have so much fun. Probably was more fun than what I'm doing now. Actually.
But it ran its course?
It ran its course, and I'm using what I knew there from that. So I don't think it's completely disconnected.
No, it's not, but it's a change.
It's a change. Yeah, and the other thing that I think I mentioned before is that you can do many things in your lifetime. And we're just I was very fortunate that I had those opportunities. Who knows, I may go back to the research lab next.
All right, I'm gonna talk about women in science and medicine then, okay? Or mm-hmm. Actually, you're going to talk about women
okay.
in science and medicine.
Okay.
And I'll just read the next question. During your 26 years on campus, what changes have you seen in the climate for women in science, or if you prefer more broadly, for all women at UW-Madison?
Oh, big changes. There's a lot more support. First of all, there's spousal hires right now. So I see more women leading the way. Women come here and they get their positions, and the male is the one who finds a position. I actually believe that this idea of spousal hires actually got a big boost because of that. Now there'd be women who need to find something, a position for the woman who comes behind. Now it's the man. And so it spousal hire has a whole different meaning.
But that's for another time. Okay. So we're talking about changes for women and in science and or in general in the last 26 years here at UW-Madison.
Right.
That's all. Just 26 years, how things change for women. Is that all right?
There are some things that have not changed, I would say. So I mean, let's put it in perspective. But there are more women here. There have been a lot more hires of women. I see more, when I first came, women were talking about maybe not, could they have children? Really, that's true. Did you have to make a choice? Nowadays, there's a lot of examples where women have children. I mean, it's not like it's easy, but they do. And so we now have, for example, it's becoming much more normal to take a tenure, to delay your, what's it called?
Delaying your tenure.
Clock.
Mm-hmm.
And even for men now. And so what's happening for women, as men also take that, it becomes more acceptable. And things that make it possible for women to lead a more normal life and be in science. What isn't changing is I still see, hear women talking about not being treated the same in departments as the males. And these are not intentional things. Who goes out to lunch together? Those kinds of things. Women aren't making many inroads, I don't think. And that hasn't changed very much. In terms of academic staff, I still think that there still is this feeling among either, I know very many women who've chosen academic staff positions because they choose to take care of their children. This is a choice, and I think it's a very valid choice. I don't think women should be criticized for that. And yet, those choices still affect the way those women think about themselves. And I think we have a long way to go toward where doing science in an academic staff position is considered to be just as respected as choosing other routes. So, you know, you make progress for women in science, but that also puts pressure on women to make certain types of choices. I still, you know, sometimes feel like I was a failure because I left the research lab. I never took a faculty position. But as I get older, I begin to realize that there's lots of ways in which I've made contributions as an academic staff member where that are quite different than a faculty member would be able to make because of the time constraints. So I think some things are changing for the better. Wisely still making a big study of it. So, I don't know what else. Is there anything else?
I think what else I would ask about that?
I think that
you know, we haven't really talked much about gender harassment issues and things like that at all. And maybe there's not nothing to really talk about. Or maybe
it's
not a good
topic. Yeah,
that's
changed, but that's changed from being a graduate student more at Michigan, where it was perfectly normal to hear, to have the you know, head of the lab and a graduate student making comments about the looks of a female. And you just sort of shake your head and roll your eyes, and they would just roll right off. Nowadays, I think that a lot more is made of that. That actually is harassment, that people have to hear that. That makes them feel uncomfortable, so therefore they may not be as productive. In my view, we were very productive, and that all happened to them. you know, I mean, we were fine. But what it means is it's a target. It's a changing target. But we felt we had to put up with, we did put up with. Now, what people have to put up with is something different. We've moved on, and they don't put up with certain things, and they do put up with certain things. So we've just changed the
boundaries.
The boundaries moved.
Yeah.
And but that's a difference.
Yeah, that's a
big
that's
difference.
Hopefully
boundaries. And what was going on before would definitely be considered harassment. The number of times at meetings when you were propositioned.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if now, probably it still happens, but at least everybody knows that that's not good. Dating of people in your lab, well, you know, that happened quite a bit. I don't know, I think now people have gotten fired for they have to have there has to be another supervisor.
Right.
You have to first relinquish your supervisory responsibilities. There was no such thought earlier. So that would be harassment.
Why do you think things have changed?
Well, you know, things change and things stay the same. I think numbers help. There are many, many more women in the workplace now than before. I think that's been increasing. And so there's unity in numbers. Why else would it have changed?
Are there any particular university committees, policy changes, leaders that you think have had appreciable impact?
Well, Joe Handelsman's definitely had an impact. Molly Carnes. They're the heads of the mm-hmm. Wisely Project.
And why do you say
these that? These are women who have not. Well, they speak up. They don't lie back and take it. And I have a lot of admiration for them. And they're still nice. You know, I mean, that gets us to another point, and that has to do with men can say certain things, and it's completely normal. Women can say exactly the same thing, and it's considered to be bitchy or, you know, not considered to be, well, I mean, it's not accepted. It's not because people mean to have a different standard, right? It's because they're comparing it to this model of what they see. This is the gender schemas.
The schemas for how.
The schemas for how.
Teresa, did you see Teresa Carey's speech earlier in the week?
Asians too.
Okay.
So we were talking about the model, what the schemas that people carry along with them. And while you have an idea of how women ought to be, Asian women have a even more distinct schema. So Asian women don't cause problems. They're seen as being very compliant, being agreeable, polite, friendly, you know, those kinds of things. And so it makes it even harder to stick up for yourself. I have had experiences where people say things, ask me if I would mind certain things, and my jaw just drops because how could they ask that of me? I don't think they would ask it of a woman. I know they wouldn't ask it of men. I think it's because I'm an Asian woman.
Can you give me an example?
Probably not for the tape. I mean, I only have a certain number.
That's fine. You were talking about, there's no need to.
Yeah.
Talking about, so the Asian experience.
Right. And
Asian woman experience.
And I can't promise you that is my interpretation.
Like you were saying earlier, you don't know. You don't, yeah. It's like you have to. So what other things?
But things have changed, actually. I find more women are, more Asian women are very spunky and forthright and direct in what they think. So maybe that will change, too. Very Americanized. I still carry a lot of the cultural value systems with me.
When you think about international students on campus, you know, who are, they may never become Americans, but they're the equivalent of a first generation. You can see how there'd be huge differences in, you know, men don't talk about that. I mean, what is that like? As you're seeing more and more students on campus, are they Asian Americans, or are they international students, or both, or I'm sure both, but I mean, what's...
They're both. We've always had a lot of international students, and they gather together. So the Asian groups socialize together. Whereas the Asian Americans tend not to socialize together. We noticed that I've noticed that since Michigan days. So you fit in and you don't really seek each other out. That's what was different about the Pacific Asian Women's Alliance. People sought each other out. And now that group is a very powerful group of women. We have I think she's the assistant vice chancellor for extension. And you know, Ruby Paredes is, I don't know what these roles are that they have, but they've all risen up pretty high at the university. So we've got a lot of Asian American leadership actually here on campus. And they're all part of Pella. So they do get together, but I'd say that there's a big difference between the international Asian students and the Asian American students. Very big difference. And of course, you know that the different Asian groups are very different themselves. And I don't fit in very well with the the Chinese Americans, the Chinese students, because I don't speak Chinese. And that's considered a big shame.
Yeah.
And I am sorry, I don't, but my parents wanted us to grow up without an accent. And so they didn't, although they spoke Cantonese to each other, they didn't want us to have an accent. They didn't realize that we wouldn't have had an accent. You know, we could have learned Chinese.
We can learn two languages.
Right. Everybody they knew in Chinatown, who were born here, had accents.
Of course, because they were just learning.
Because they were learning it, and they learned their English from each other, and so they had accents.
Right, right.
But we wouldn't have in Rochester. But in any case, I don't. No, I am married to a Chinese, and so I do have more associations with Chinese than a lot of Chinese Americans.
Does he speak Chinese?
Yeah, he was born in China, but he came when he was 3. So he's very Americanized, but he also speaks Chinese and has much closer ties. Whereas I'm fourth generation, third or fourth generation.
Wow, yeah, okay.
So.
Anything else you want to talk about?
In that the regard. Intersection of.
There's no rush.
No.
I think it's interesting that the group, that this group you're talking about, PAWA, is that P-A-W-A,
mm-hmm.
that group has risen to in the university quite a bit as individuals. You know, you can't help but suspect that that group support has helped make people more courageous and made them feel, you know, more willing to take on stuff and more willing to speak out themselves and do, you know, I'm sure that, I mean, how can that not be the case,
yeah,
you know?
That's right. That's right. It's always good.
How did that group start?
I wasn't one of the founders.
Do you remember who was?
I would suspect that Jan Miyasaki and Peggy Choi were among the early ones, founders. Then there's some people who left this university.
Okay, that's all right. Let's talk about Wisely then.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2001, you've been a leadership team member for the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Initiative, known as Wisely. It's saying, please briefly explain what Wisely is. Okay, let's explain what Wisely is and talk about how you became involved with it and what your involvement has been.
Wisely was formed from a research grant, called the Advance Program at NSF to advance women in science. And what it was designed to be is a research program. It was to study women in science. And so there are a number of projects to look at, for example, communication, women's communication. There's some studies on they did a big needs assessment on women's experience in the workplace here of the faculty. Actually, that spread to women and men. And
a fabulous climate survey.
A fabulous climate
survey. That's fair, because we gathered.
Oh, did you do that? That's what you did? Oh, okay. But also
a climate. Actually, it's a real tough survey. Whether it was great or not, I don't know.
It's a workplace climate survey.
Right.
And also the one for the academic staff. You did also?
We gathered the data. We helped.
Okay.
We argued over the instrument and gathered the data.
Yeah, well, I argued with over the instrument, too. Originally, it was just take the faculty one and make it into an academic staff one.
Right.
I really did not think that worked at all. And so
they're
I helped.
Totally different experiences. Right.
Make the changes. So there was that. But in any case, it was to document the situation with women in science. And really, the focus is on leadership. And so how do women leaders conduct themselves? How do people get their voices heard? And then there was going to be some testing of things like chairs workshops for chairs to improve the climate in their departments. Would these workshops work? And publications will come from this. So it's truly a research institute. I think I explained on the tape how I got involved. It really had to be, I was on an ad hoc committee that was between the Equity and Diversity Resource Center Advisory Committee and the Committee on Women got together. And And they were talking about, Joe and Molly were on the Committee on Women, were talking about writing this grant. And I asked, are you going to include in the Leadership Institute academic staff women and talk about, are there ways in which academic staff women could play a leadership role? That got translated into a project which was trying to see whether or not it would be possible for women who are academic staff to become faculty. Actually, that wasn't my idea, but but I was saying that a lot of the people in academic staff positions are just as qualified and in science are just as well known, in fact, bring in as much money as the faculty. And so they are just as much leaders in the field of science. And right. Are we going to look at that?
And many of them are probably doing work that is better suited to certain leadership administrative things, too. I mean,
well,
depending on the person, I suppose.
Depends on the person. I think that in some ways, because they are full-time doing research in the field, they are publishing more. I mean,
yeah.
They'd have more opportunity. It's a different role. So they're very influential in science. So why are we, can we think about how they can play a leadership role on this campus
right.
and use that, those leadership skills, which they must have.
Right.
And also because we want to increase the visibility of women in science for our students. Well, if they're hidden away in the research labs, but they are really doing dynamite science, short of having, of course, we do want to get more students into research labs, and then they'll see this. But
right.
it would be nice to see whether they could play a role.
And see those roles as first-class roles.
Yes, right. We changed that. So anyway, Wisely has had... I've been involved in one initiative, which is celebrating women in science, which was to look at proposals from departments to bring women speakers or workshops or to to celebrate the women who are making it in science. Another purpose of that grants program was to bring in perhaps some younger women into departments that didn't have women in the faculty, to show the faculty that in fact there are a lot of people who could be in the pipeline and might be attracted to be hired here on campus. So I've been working on that committee. Originally the role was perhaps a little bit, I had thought would be more along the lines of finding ways in which we could help the women in academic staff positions. But we waited. We've been waiting for the needs assessment to be analyzed for the academic staff to see where we might make a difference. So we haven't done anything in that.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it has meant a lot to me to be included in that group. It's a wonderful group.
Excellent.
Women.
So yeah.
It's another support group.
Good for time.
It seems very strange to me the number of women who are not in science. Who are in Wisely.
Yeah.
Because their research area, the research is social research.
Right.
So they have to have social research.
And social scientists, right? That's right.
But,
yeah. In fact, I remember looking at some interview. That was one thing that I spent some time on, is a qualitative interview schedule.
Just running, you know.
Oh, sorry. Let's get back to it. Okay. How and why did you become involved with the initiative? Did we talk about that enough?
Yeah.
Okay. And your nature involvement, and what have you learned through your work with Wisely?
What have I learned?
Maybe nothing.
Well, I've learned a lot because I go to the seminars. One thing I've learned is that there are a lot of people doing research on women on this campus that I didn't know about at all. And the other thing I learned was from all those studies that they've done. Learned about patterns of speech that I didn't know about before.
Yeah.
Women's patterns of speech. That's interesting. I learned the numbers. There are some, how are we doing on this campus? And I've met a lot of really wonderful women. I think that's the main thing.
That's a good thing too. What impact do you think Wisely will have or has had?
I think it's raised the the awareness of a problem on this campus. They have, and the other thing is, it's got such far-reaching effects. The CERTL diversity team, they're looking at what Wisely's done. The Equity and Diversity Resource Center Advisory Committee, they're talking about having Wisely come and talk about what they've done. It's reaching into all areas, I think. They because of their funding, they've been able to do really good, top-notch work that speaks to issues that lots of groups care about. I think it's, and Bernice Durand, who was on the Wisely Leadership Committee to begin with, is now the Vice Chancellor for Diversity. And I actually think it's through Wisely she got informed about a lot of these issues. So I think it'll have a big impact.
What do you think will happen in the future? What do you see next?
I'm hoping that it will continue. You know, when the NSF funding runs out, that there will be, since it is a research institute, that it will be able to get new money to continue this research.
Yeah. All right, my next question. We're switching topics here. Career and family.
Oh. That's such a hard one. We're talking about that right now. Career and family. I always wanted to do a better job, I think. Well, throughout my life, I have felt not very good at any one of, either being a scientist, I could have been a better scientist, and I could have been a better wife and mother. I think that's the state of women at this particular time. We're expected to be super women. You know, you go home and you still do the major parenting. You still do the major cooking, cleaning. I mean, I'm not saying my husband does a lot, but I still feel that that's been my role. And then at work, the way that the work is structured, you feel you should be able to spend, you know, stay on until 6:30 like other people, and you should be able to come in for an 8 o'clock meeting, and you feel bad when you have to leave to pick up your children. When I had to pick up my children at 5:30, anyway, it's
at
just always
just
it's a lot
train.
Of guilt. There's guilt all the time with how you're doing in these various roles. I now feel that I probably should have, given my career and everything, I should have taken more time with my family. I wish that I had had a little more insight into, it wouldn't have made that much difference if I had taken more time when the kids were young. I just had my view that you put your own blinders on, that I wouldn't be able to make it in science if I went part-time doing science, but I probably could have cut off some hours doing that. I could have spent more time doing that. And I'm sorry, because it really, those years when the kids are young, really short. In the long run, very short. And so I guess I feel that way. And yet, I don't seem to be able to stop myself. From working.
That was what I was going to ask you next. You know, there's when you look at the two and step back, but then there's the actually doing it and not getting to do the work part. You're obviously someone who has enjoyed working.
I enjoy working.
You know?
I enjoy working a lot.
Yeah.
And so even with that said, I could at this very moment do more with the family. And as I get into towards grandparent age, I think to myself, will I have a chance? You know, am I going to keep working, or am I going to give myself a chance to spend the time with grandchildren? We shall see. but that's this thing that you end up with, just never feeling good about the way you balance these things. This part of the table has to do with being a balancing. So one of the reasons I did leave the research world. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons was that with the experiments, my husband did all 2-day experiments, and I did 2-day experiments. So I did Thursday, Friday experiments, and he did Tuesday, Wednesday experiments. And when my son said, you know, who's going to be home tonight, you know, I realized that we had such an abnormal life that he didn't ever expect 2 parents to be home. It was going to be 1 parent who was doing the experiment. And I didn't want to be that kind of a mother. And so that was one reason that I hoped that my next job would be a little bit freer, but it wasn't. But then, it turns out it's me. But at the time, that was one of the reasons why I gave up.
And it may be both. Doesn't have to be one or the other, you know?
That's right. But we did try to balance it. I mean, when we went to meetings, one big part of being a scientist is you present your work at meetings, and that's when you feel good about it. But you've got children. So what do you do with these children? So we went to meetings a couple of times when we only had the one child. We'd take him with us to these neuroscience meetings. And we would just take turns. Which talks people went to. And then they almost always, one thing that really helped a lot was if they had some kind of a daycare, for a drop-in daycare at that city, and they made arrangements. Minneapolis, I remember the neuroscience meeting in Minneapolis, they had Y daycare, which my son was very happy at. And that helps women a lot if the meetings take into account the children. But we did try to, as I say, balance this family and work. I don't think we did a very, very good job, but it's always been a problem for me, not feeling adequate in any of these roles that I take. And then, of course, being a wife is also a role that actually takes backseat to both the work and the rearing children.
It all makes perfect sense. I mean, who wouldn't in that situation have that? So, you know, I mean, you were mentioning that one of the things that was really helpful, and you've mentioned a few of these things, but I'm going to ask the question because I have it down here, that having daycare at the meetings is one thing that's helpful. You talked about spousal hires earlier. Are there other changes university has implemented to make it easier for faculty and staff to balance work and home lives?
Wisely is looking into that, for one thing. I think having good childcare is really important. There aren't enough good options for taking care of your children. The daycares for infants there's a big shortage in that area right at this point, at this time. There are daycares after they become 2, you know, that there are quite a few good ones in Madison. We're very lucky. When they start school, it's almost worse because schools have so many holidays. The daycares usually could go full time, but the school holidays, you have to be able to juggle that. So our children went to Waisman Center Daycare, which is part of the university. It was an excellent daycare, and so the university does have some of their own daycares. But then when Waisman Center would close, we had to find some place that would allow us to take them in as drop-ins. Well, it's not very easy to do, and
everybody
it's not very
needs
good
one
for
the
children.
Same day. Everybody
yes,
needs one the
that's
same
right,
day.
That's right. And then the other thing is that when your children are sick, of course you want to be at home, but that's a big problem. I don't know what the answer is for that, because the children don't want to be somewhere else when they're sick. So maybe having some sort of flexibility. I don't know what the answer is, but the university could help with that aspect.
Part of that whole workaholism,
right.
Nothing can wait a day.
I would love to see childcare that's closer to the workplace. I used to ride my bike down to Weisman to have lunch with my kids when they were there. That was very nice. Now that's not what you consider close, but it was close. It was closer than a lot of people have their childcare.
Right.
I could still do it. And I think that that would have helped a lot if it had been even closer to the building. When my children got to be in sixth grade, we thought that those after school programs, there are no more programs after fifth grade, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But they're still not old enough to stay home on their own. So we let our children stay home on their own, and both had trouble at the beginning. And so they came to the university, and they did their homework outside my office, and they were kept busy, mm-hmm. so I could sort of still keep an eye on them, but do my work. I wonder if the university might find mm-hmm. something for these in-between kids.
At that time,
right after school. Well, no, fun things. I mean, there's got to be things that the university has that could help. But that's a big problem for parents who work.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those...
In summer.
And they get on Mondays, they get off at 2 in the afternoon. That's a long time from 2 o'clock until the end of your day. And summer. Summer is a big problem.
So in your experience, do you think the careers of male and female faculty members or staff members are affected in different ways by these family responsibilities? I mean, obviously they are, but how are they is the question.
They are. I don't mean to say that, I know in a lot of families the males take the primary role, and so they're going to worry as much about this as the females, but I don't know, it still seems possible for the men to... in general, to make it to late meetings and early meetings. It's true, they tend to be able to. And the women are left having to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And so that makes you feel guilty. It still leaves the perception that, you took this job, you know, there's equality. You made the choice. You should be able to make these late meetings and early morning meetings. Even though it's after, yeah, that's right. So I think it affects you because it fulfills the schema of so many people in leadership roles. You're still feeding that perception that they have, and you feel bad about it. When actually, no one should have to stay after hours, right?
Right. Well, I think we may be at our question when we ask, are there any other final comments you want to make?
You know, I think when I answered the question about what could the university do to help women in science,
other things.
I was talking about home things.
Okay.
Home life,
yeah, family,
and childcare.
Family and career is what
family
they were talking
and career.
About. But we can
was
talk
there,
about other parts
But it
too.
Seems like there are other things that the university might be able to look at. And that is there some way for the academic staff, for the people who are on soft money, grant money, who've been at this university for a very, very long time and are loyal to this university, is there some way that their contributions or their skills or their abilities could be made acceptable for them to contribute to the university that would make them keep them happy, make a broader job than just that soft money. Now that might mean resources, because you can't make it volunteer work. All right, you know, sure. Get your money from the grant, and we'd love to see you also do this and that and this and that.
Right.
But if there was some way that it could become broader, I really think that would help a lot of women who are doing science have a less invisible role at the university while they. I'd like to see that happen. Listen. That might have kept me in the research lab longer, actually, if I could have found a way to...
Part of your job
would
be to, be doing that?
Well, I could have perhaps taught a course.
Yeah.
You know, I could have taken my research in some way and fed it into the teaching arena. Took my research and joining it in. There might, that's just an example. I think that it depends on the interests of the people who are in the research labs.
I always have to make notes because you make me think about other things.
Well, I was telling you one of the reasons I did leave was because of this feeling of isolation. I think we could do something to get people to feel like they're more they were part of the bigger picture on campus, and so then they would stay in science. I mean, I'm not really in science in a lot of ways. I'm not in research anymore. I'm using it, but I'm not doing it. I guess that's what I'm saying.
I'm noting other questions that are unrelated to our interview that I'll ask you about afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. Well, any final comments? Anything else?
I think we covered that. Okay, good. Thanks.